Superman is set to enter the public domain in 2034. Granted, this will be Superman as he appeared in 1938's Action Comics number 1, in which Lois and Clark are reporters for the Daily Star, and there's no Perry White or Jimmy Olsen, no Lex Luthor, Brainiac, Metallo, Bizarro, or Mick Yespitlick. Superman couldn't even fly yet, although, like Samurai Jack, he could jump good. Most of these attributes would be gradually added to the character as he rapidly exploded in popularity and was spun off into other media. A syndicated newspaper comic began less than 12 months after Action Comics number 1, with a radio program beginning in 1940. They would fill in a lot of the mythos. There's a persistent rumor that K-Metal, as it was first known, later Kryptonite, was introduced to the radio show so that voice actor Bud Collier could go on vacation. There were interesting stretches where Superman is comatose from kryptonite poisoning, and his best friend Batman just shows up and investigates what happened to his buddy for a week or two. The Superman theatrical shorts animated at Fleischer Studios were, to make an understatement, a significant contributor to the development of Superman in particular and the superhero genre in general. Launched a mere 3 years after the character's debut, they were likely the first exposure to Superman for many of the people who encountered them. The ripples left behind by these handful of cartoons have spread far and wide. Everyone from Bruce Timm to Hayao Miyazaki have taken inspiration from them. And in terms of the mark left on Superman, it's fair to say that every subsequent iteration of the character has taken something from the Fleischer shorts. We'll be talking about how and why, and lots of uncomfortable subtext over the course of this recording. My name is Ryan, this is A Real Deep Dive. Alright, joining me on this one is my brother Sylvan.
Hello.
And my sister Sarah.
Hi.
And joining us in his debut, Carlos.
Oh, hello.
A little louder.
Hi.
Yeah, all right, that's better. The reason why I invited Carlos to this one is because all of us were Batman people, and I figured we needed a Superman guy to talk about Superman, and Carlos, you were a Superman guy.
Unfortunately for this crowd, yes, that's very correct.
No, we need a Superman guy.
It's pretty easy to find Batman guys.
Yeah, Batman guys are common as muck, especially amongst millennials. You know, the Tim Burton movies, the animated series. Batman was having a moment in the late 80s, early 90s. But, what is it about Superman that appeals to you? Why are you a Superman guy?
That feels like a very loaded question. For me personally, I just kind of like the fact that the character is doing what I think is social justice, despite the fact that he has the power to do whatever he wants. He chooses to be kind and good as opposed to like a evil dictator or some sort of demigod that takes over the world.
You hear that, people making Superman movies right now?
I think the appeal of a lot of the most popular and iconic iterations of Superman, especially the movies with Christopher Reeve, is that he has the powers of an earthbound god, but he's pulling kittens out of trees.
Yeah, which is why they're some of my all-time favorites, but yeah, I have, you know, some bones to pick with Snyder personally, but we can talk about that in another episode. But yeah, no, that's kind of the basic reason for why I like Superman over any other of the DC cast.
And when I first contacted you about doing a podcast about Superman, I raised, like, you know, which iteration we could do. We could do the Bruce Timm Superman the Animated Series, or the Richard Donner movies, or the Fleischer shorts. And you were like, ooh, let's do the Fleischer shorts. Do you remember saying, ooh, let's do the Fleischer shorts? And if so, why?
Oh, no, I do remember. Because I think for one of the most, I think probably one of the more memorable pieces of media for Superman for like the longest time, it's not really talked about that often. Because when I think of like Superman in popular culture, I think of like Reeves and onwards, as opposed to anything from like the early days from the Golden Era or anything prior to that too. So it's just one of those things where I think a lot of people know a lot about Superman, but not necessarily the actual origins of the character. So I was really excited to talk about the shorts just because we're actually literally seeing the myth be made right before our eyes too, since we already see the inconsistencies of his powers.
Yeah, this is a formative proto-Superman, as Sylvan pointed out. The Superman isn't as powerful as we're accustomed to seeing him. He strains when he's trying to put the building back into place.
It adds a lot more tension to the shorts than you see in some of the other versions because, like, he's got so many more vulnerabilities. It does make him more interesting. That's something that a lot of writers, especially more recently, have had to grapple with, like, how to bring that sort of dramatic tension into stories when he's nigh on invincible. Either that or kryptonite just becomes insanely common.
Or Jimmy Olsen turns into a giant turtle.
Yeah, that too.
Okay, well, let's get into the development of this. For the backgrounds, brothers Max and Dave Fleischer founded Fleischer Studios in 1929. Neither was as charismatic as Walt Disney, but they are arguably just as ambitious, and they were definitely far more creative. Rougher, grittier, darker, and hornier, the Fleischer shorts of the 30s served as a more hip and naughty rival to the refined and family-friendly Disney model, something that, to a degree, Looney Tunes shorts and the early DreamWorks feature movies would also play into in later decades. The Fleischers were also eager to invest in technological innovations for the new animation medium, with the most noteworthy advance being rotoscoping. This technique, as Cheryl has denigrated in many prior episodes, involved animators tracing over motion picture footage frame by frame on top of glass to produce realistic motion. This is often used as a shortcut, as Cheryl pointed out, whenever we talk about, say, a Ralph Bakshi film.
It does give a sort of, I'd say realistic movement is a bit of a stretch. It has an uncanny valley aspect to it.
It definitely looks uncanny when it's not done well, which is often, but say in Snow White, the rotoscoping is very well executed. Max Fleischer first used rotoscoping for the groundbreaking Out of the Inkwell series, which began in 1918. Its main character, Coco the Clown, became a core component of the studio, alongside short starring Bimbo, Betty Boop, and Popeye the Sailor. Following the success of Snow White, Fleischer Studios convinced their distributor Paramount to greenlight an animated feature-length adaptation of Gulliver's Travels. The studio relocated from New York City to Florida during that period in order to take advantage of lower tax rates and also crush a unionization attempt from its staff. This happened roughly at the same time as the Disney strike. Interesting fact here, Jack Kirby, then an in-betweener at Fleischer Studios, shifted to drawing comics after he lost his job as a cartoonist. He would later hook up with Joe Simon at Will Eisner's shop and create Captain America.
And it worked out pretty okay for him.
Yeah, and if you look at the Simon Kirby comics from the 40s, especially when contrasted against the other comics there, they're a lot more fluid and better executed with more panel-by-panel storytelling, and Kirby working as an in-betweener makes a lot of sense in that context. Because in-betweening is, if you're not aware, the grunt work. Like, the director will do two keyframes, and the in-betweener does all of the boring in-between stuff.
Yeah, the shots that connect the main action poses.
Gulliver's Travels was a commercial success, and Paramount approved of a follow-up entitled Mr. Bug Goes to Town, a riff on Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. However, the relationship between Dave and Max began to deteriorate during this period due to creative conflicts, the stress of the move, and Dave's very open and adulterous affair with the secretary Mae Schwartz that Max disapproved of. By the time Gulliver was released in 1939, they were not on speaking terms, which is awkward considering that they are running an expensive animation studio together. Dave seized all creative control in 1940, leaving Max to focus on the business side, although if you'll notice in the Superman shorts, his name appears above the title. Popeye was still drawing crowds, but new projects like Gabby, Stone Age cartoons, and animated antics were flops. Mr. Bug Goes to Town was also experiencing numerous production headaches during this period. Neither Dave nor Max were eager to add Superman to the studio's workload when Paramount acquired the film rights in 1940. In order to decline the project without insulting Paramount, they offered to take on the job for the hefty price tag of $100,000 per short, which was 4 to 6 times the budget of the popular and well-funded Popeye series. To the shock of the Fleischers, Paramount did not take Superman to another studio and instead entered into negotiations, arguing Max down to a budget of $50,000 for the first short and then $30,000 for the other ones. This was a far bigger paycheck than the Fleischers had ever seen before, and they were essentially obligated to accept the Superman job at that point. And that brings us to our first short, which is just titled Superman, although it is occasionally known as The Mad Scientist.
I think this was the easy favorite of the night.
Largely for one element, which we'll get to. All right, in the Daily Planet building, editor Perry White reveals to his two best field reporters, Clark Kent and Lois Lane, that an anonymous figure has mailed another threatening note, saying that he's going to use his electrothanasia ray to destroy Metropolis. White assigns Kent to help Lois follow up her lead, but Lois instead insists that she'd like the chance to crack the story on her own and takes off before getting the chief's approval. Lois takes off in a private plane to an undisclosed location at the top of a mountain, where the villain's secluded lair laboratory is located. He is preparing to fire his futuristic weapon, a particle beam or death ray of some sort, until his pet Vulture, who's a delight. The Vulture is animated in a way that makes me think of 1930s anthropomorphic animal Fleischer shorts, particularly Bimbo.
And we're still not confident that he's a vulture.
He's vulture-ish and part raven. He has some air about him of Magicka Dispel's pet raven slash brother Poe. so he's black and purple and fabulous looking, and then the villain is very queer-coded and also lovely.
Oh, and don't forget his eyes. His eyes are like
the rainbow
purple
eyes.
And yellow and red, I think.
And he's got Claw's Nomi hair, which Sylvan sees as goals.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and his fingertips and the pajamas. No, and he's got excellent eye makeup. No, everything about this queer-coded villain is lovely. He is fashion goals, and these characters should have come back.
Upon Lois's arrival, she is kidnapped, bound, and gagged as the scientist boasts to her about the success of his plan. At this point, it is very obvious that the scientist has the same voice actor as Popeye. And then he demonstrates the weapon's power by aiming it at a bridge and destroying it. While listening to the radio, Clark and the other journalists learn of the coming disaster as the police alert everyone to stay in their homes. Instinctively, Clark steps into a storage room and changes into Superman before flying away. The mad scientist then has his beam weapon weaken the foundations of the Daily Planet skyscraper, causing
it
to tip
all
over.
Which goes all jello-y.
Yeah, it is very rubber hosey. Fortunately, Superman arrives in time and prevents the structure from crashing into the neighboring buildings or falling to the ground, successfully restoring the skyscraper to its upright orientation. Superman then pushes the death ray away from the base of the skyscraper and attempts to fight it back to its source, but the scientist increases the weapon's power, which also sends erratic pulses of energy in Superman's way. However, Superman remains determined to fight, persevering against the beam by punching it. It's the most superhero solution to a problem ever. I'm gonna punch this death ray into submission.
I literally had America Fuck Yeah like being played in my head while that was going on because I felt it was very
also funny. I just wanna ask for some clarification. At the beginning you said that Clark Kent was one of his top reporters, right?
Yep.
Do we ever see Clark successfully report anything?
It was all Lois.
Not in these shorts, no.
Lois constantly talks about him fainting.
Once again, I mean, this is a popular fan theory for later iterations of the character, but Sylvan maintains that they all know, they're just humoring him.
They've gotta be.
Especially with the, as we talk about with the Birdman later on, like, there's no way other than it had to have been Clark that was Superman that kind of saved them from being melted into gold.
Yeah, there are instances where Perry White is like, oh no, Lois has been kidnapped. Somebody should do something, Kent. I'm gonna turn around and look at these papers, Kent.
Dot, dot, dot.
Oh no, there aren't any phone booths around.
Or go to your office or start, you know.
Anyways, Superman reaches the death ray and twists the barrel into a knot, preventing the beam of energy from escaping and building up an intense amount of pressure, which causes the machine to overload and explode. And oh boy, was that explosion pretty. So many colors everywhere.
Yeah. The illustration of this work is like, it's even after like 80 plus years, it still holds up pretty well with anything contemporary.
Yeah, these are gorgeous looking cartoons. Superman rescues Lois and captures the scientist just before the lair explodes. The Buzzard manages to escape, by the way. Superman just throws the scientist into prison, literally.
Due process? Nah.
The scene dissolves back to the Daily Planet building where Clark Kent and Lois report back to Perry White. Lois has gotten the scoop of the story of the mad scientist, thanks to Superman, and White commends her for doing so. Only Clark, however, has the real scoop, winking at the audience at the end, which is the first time that does that. That is the Superman wink. Although George Reeves' Superman wink is generally seen as the best one.
It's just nice to see him have eyeballs, because he doesn't always necessarily have eyeballs in these shorts either.
This is a very squinty Superman.
But no, I thoroughly enjoyed it. But to what Sylvan was saying, it is very interesting to just see the quick-coded of the bone, especially in this one, because you could just see that it's always with like a certain type of sharp haircut or like a widow's peak or something along those lines. And as a kid, you know, watching this, it went over my head, but now watching it as an adult, you're like, oh, that's...
Yeah, he has.
I'm instantly like, they're trying to insult us, but nah, I claim him. He's one of ours.
He has a German expressionist design, and German expressionism was incredibly gay, which is why Claw's Nomi latched onto it to begin with.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not using queer-coded as a negative. I like him. I want more of him.
This episode is written by Steve Nytel, who is Max Fleischer's son-in-law, and Isidore Sparber. Dave Fleischer is the credited director, but it'd be more accurate to describe him as an executive producer or a supervising director. At Fleischer Studios, most of the nuts and bolts of directing the animation actually fell to the key animators, who in this case were Steve Muffati and Frank Andres. The high budget and lessons learned from Gulliver's Travels led to a great deal of care and craft on Superman. The characters cast shadows, which is incredibly rare now, let alone back then. And there are acute details and highly complex layouts. And as I already mentioned, the color palette is both expansive and nuanced. Now, usually when I do cartoon shorts for this podcast, I consult this giant book that Sylvan gave me as a hand-me-down from their college days called Hollywood Cartoons. It is 600 pages long and is very thorough, especially for that UPA episode. But for Superman, they only devoted a page and a half, which surprised me, because this is a big deal for the Golden Age of Animation. But one particular bit I wanted to highlight here is here where they talk to the animators briefly. B. Miller said, there was no rotoscoping, just animated from sketches. The characters in the Superman cartoons move woodenly, but they are in any case emphatically subordinate to the extraordinarily plentiful explosions and robots. It's such a catty way to damn them with faint praise. There's an extensive chapter on the Fleischers here in Hollywood Cartoons, but as Sylvan pointed out to me on the ride over, the writer is very anti-rotoscoping, and that colors his perceptions of the studio. Rotoscoping was used for certain character scenes, as I mentioned, but it was impractical for Superman's action scenes. It is hard to direct an actor to punch a death ray and then just trace over it. Accustomed to animating caricatured humans and anthropomorphic animals, live referenced models were brought in so the artist could maintain the Superman cast more realistic proportions. Relatively speaking, these are still very cartoony people. Paramount uncharacteristically promoted Superman with an advertising campaign. This was highly unorthodox treatment for an animated short film, which is traditionally seen as disposable filler on a theatrical bill up to this point. The short was massively successful and got an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Short, losing to the Pluto cartoon Lend a Paw. It also ranked at number 33 on the 50 Best Cartoons of All Time list. I mentioned this list on the UPA episode. Most of these types of lists are just out there so you can bitch about what's on or what shouldn't be on or what's ranked too high or low in the comment section, but in this case it was like, good job list, you nailed it. And yes, the first Superman short should be on there somewhere. Bruce Timm modeled the Art Deco aesthetic of Batman the Animated Series on Fleischer's Superman. This should be very obvious to anybody who is familiar with both programs. This short features shots that Timm swiped for Almost Got Him and Heart of Steel, particularly the bit where Batman destroys Hardak. He modeled the Mad Scientist lair after that. Brad Bird also cites this short as a core visual influence on the Iron Giant, and it is actually quoted in the film itself. This is the first instance where Superman is seen as a protector of truth and justice. The American Way was added in 1942. Alright, that brings us to our next short, The Mechanical Monsters.
The microphone probably didn't pick that up, but Sarah just snorted derisively.
Alright, we open with a robot who robs a bank and flies into a mad scientist, a different mad scientist, a far less fabulous one, although he's got a nice mustache.
Yeah. He does look a bit like Vincent Price.
Yeah.
And the
just doesn't have the charisma.
And the robot unloads a pile of cash into the vault. The robot is controlled completely from the scientist's command center, and many robots similar to it are lined up along the walls of the lair. The front page of the Daily Planet reports that the robot's robbery is occurring right alongside an announcement for the display of $50 million of the world's rarest gems at a local museum. And now, my
great head... care has been taken.
My headcanon is that this mad scientist was hired by the museum as some kind of insurance fraud scheme, but if that's the case, the museum got away with it.
Good for them!
Yeah, they probably don't have a lot of funding.
Later, as Lois and Clark are covering the museum's exhibit for the Planet, a robot lands in the street outside. As Sarah noticed, it is the number 5 robot in certain scenes and the number 13 in others.
Listen, the numbers bothered me on the robots. They're not organized chronologically, and it really bothers me.
Yeah, for a guy who built 25 robots, he is very much not on the spectrum. The police pelt it with Tommy gun fire, and it ricochets everywhere.
Because they were prepared, apparently.
Gosh, that was probably my favorite part, too, just because of the sheer absurdity of the bullets just flying all over the place, too, bouncing off of the robot.
They killed so many civilians. R.I.P.
Museum visitors, including Lois and Clark, flee as the robot marches towards the jewels and begins loading them into an opening in its back. While Clark phones the Planet from the nearby phone booth, Lois climbs into the robot's back. Because
she has no care for her own personal safety.
Or does she need to? Superman's following her around like a guardian angel.
I mean, like, even by Lois Lane standards, Fleischer Lois is very foolhardy.
Yeah, I was going to say, she's a character in and of herself. I probably like her more than actually Clark or Superman himself in the shorts, too. It's sheer audacity.
Clark emerges from the booth, notices that Lois is gone, and just assumes that she's been kidnapped by the robots, because of course she has.
The super hearing thing is clearly not a thing yet.
He heads back into the phone booth and changes his clothes, emerging as Superman. This is the first time the Superman ever changed in a phone booth,
you
by
know
the
what
way.
What really bothers me, too, is that he changes like a normal person in these shorts, and he doesn't do like the rapid spin movement, changing very quickly. He takes his sweet time getting ready for battle, basically.
He must have an astronomical clothing budget. Because he just leaves his suits everywhere.
I think they also just wanted to show off, like, how much natural-looking movement they could do on the, like, taking off of the clothes and putting on of the cape, because that is showing off.
Yeah, that's probably the case, because, as Carlos pointed out, in the 1966 Filmation Superman, he just spins around and becomes Superman, because they didn't have the money to have him do anything more than that. Yeah, the first superhero to actually bitch about having to lose his clothes all the time is Spider-Man, which, as Sarah pointed out, like, that seems like more of a Hulk problem.
It's a fun logistical nightmare in the Animorph series.
Flying above the city, Superman spots the robot and uses his X-ray vision to see Lois inside, and oh boy, is that X-ray vision scene very uncanny. He lands on it and struggles to open the door in the back, only to have the scientist...
Which is a terrible solution, like, he needs to think.
Only to have the scientist maneuver the robot upside down and throw him off onto a power line, tangling up into the wires. As the robot is upside down, the door flies open, with all the jewels falling out in the process, with Lois surviving only by hanging on for dear life until the robot flips back over.
Excellent that scene was, screaming by the voice actress.
I was
going
to say, like, the screams for all the women in these shorts were fantastic.
Yeah, they're very universal monster movie screams. As Superman struggles to free himself from the wires, the robot arrives at the lair, but instead of jewels, the scientist finds Lois in its payload. Infuriated, he demands to know what she did with the jewels, but she suggests that he read about it in tomorrow's papers. After she sees his expression, she's like, oh wait, this guy might actually want to hurt me. The next time we see her, she is being bound and gagged on a platform held over a pot of boiling metal in part of what appears to be an industrial foundry. The scientist pulls a lever, which starts some machinery gradually lowering her closer and closer to the liquid. Meanwhile, Superman frees himself from the power lines and knocks down the door to the scientist's lair, only to meet the army of robots. Under the scientist's control, the robots emit fire from nozzles positioned on the lower part of their heads. Fire is tough to animate, and this fire looks awesome, as Sarah mentioned while we were watching it.
Yeah, it was very pretty fire.
And encircle Superman and they pound them with their fists. Initially, the robots seem to have the upper hand, beating Superman to the ground, but Superman defeats them, sending the scientist running. When Superman catches up with him, he is holding a knife to the rope holding Lois's platform above the molten metal, and threatens to cut it if he takes another step.
Oh, we also got a beautiful overview of the lair with, like, that technique where there's, like, multiple cells placed over each other to create depth.
Yeah, yeah, there's a nice multi-plane camera shot that also is a pan, and oh boy, that must have been a logistical nightmare to animate. Superman catches Lois just in time, but the scientist pulls a lever to dump the hot liquid on them, but Superman shields Lois with his cape, which, as Sylphin pointed out, Tim uses that for Batman in the animated series a lot. And he catches the scientist and flies from the lair to take him and Lois back to the city. The next edition of the planet details that the robots are destroyed, the jewels are recovered somehow, and the scientist is incarcerated for the thefts. In the office, Clark says, "That's a wonderful story," with Lois replying, "Thanks, Clark, but I owe it all to Superman." And then Superman gives a knowing smile, but he's too squinty to wink this time.
It's true. Although the powers and consistencies were kind of showed up again, too, here, because I can't believe that, like, regular electrical power wires would just be such a struggle for him, whereas fighting 25 robots that spit out fire and the lava scene later on were, like, nothing but a... just like an annoyance to him towards the end. So it's just really funny to see his power set, because he can basically become like a glorified Captain America to being like almost average Joe at certain points. It's very funny to see it.
Yeah, he does get beaten to the ground, yeah. But yeah, at the same time. All right, this one has the credited director being Dave Fleischer again. It was actually directed by Steve Muffati and George Germanetti, and it was written by Steve Nytel and Isidore Sparber again. This is the only time that Fleischer Superman uses X-ray vision, probably because it was so awkward looking. The mechanical monster has been referenced many times. It menaces Lupin the Third in episode 155 of the TV series Lupin the Third Part 2. Its director, Hayao Miyazaki, also features a very similar-looking robot in his 1986 feature film Castle in the Sky. A very mechanical-looking monster kidnaps Mr. Freeze in Batman the Animated Series episode Deep Freeze, even puts him in his back like the mechanical monster does. It shows up as one of the trophies that Superman keeps in the Fortress of Solitude in the not-very-good 2007 animated film Superman Doomsday. A mechanical monster is also present in the 1994 episode of The Tick vs. Brainchild. Oh, in that case, it is a cyborg dog. But it has a propulsion flying system very similar to this mechanical monster and conducts robberies in a very similar way. Superman is referenced as fighting mechanical monsters in an episode of Young Justice. A news report on the episode shows the fight occurring on November 28th at the time being 1941. The show's release date. The 2004 film Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow lifts many elements of this short, including its basic plot. Alright, that brings us to the next one, The Arctic Giant.
What a weird episode.
Yeah, this is an odd one. The story begins as the narrator tells about an Arctic giant, you don't say, found frozen in perfect condition millions of years ago in Siberia. The dinosaur-like monster, although it's called a Tyrannosaurus, is shipped to the Museum of Natural Science in Metropolis, where it is refrigerated with equipment and is kept frozen because even the scientists are like, if this thaws out, it's still alive and it's gonna go on a rampage. Lois Lane is sent to do a story on the monster because of the whole, if it thaws out, it might be alive. As she is leaving the planet, Clark asks if she wants him to come with her, but Lois says, no thanks, you'd probably faint if you saw the monster. You scare so easily. And if Sylvan's pet theory is true, yeah, she's just actively having fun with him. Then once she leaves the room, Clark says, maybe she's right, but Superman hasn't fainted yet. While Lane is still in earshot, Clark. At the museum, Lois is shown around the refrigeration plant that is responsible for keeping the monster frozen.
And they are not doing a very good job.
Yeah, the guy shows her the generator and then proceeds to show her the control room downstairs. He places an oil can on the shelf right next to the generator, and through just the vibrations of the generator functioning, it falls right into the gears, collapsing the generator's movement and causing the ice to start melting. The workers nearby turn off the equipment so they can quickly repair the damage, but it is too late. The ice around the monster fades away completely, and while police officers try to escort everyone out of the museum, Lois stays behind and tries to call the Daily Planet. The monster revives and destroys the entire building, leaving her in the rubble. The monster escapes as the police squad shoots at it. The monster doesn't even seem to be mad at the police shooting at it, just kind of contemptuous, like, bitch, really?
The vibe that I get from the monster the whole time is like in the episode of the Rugrats where they all play at being Reptar, and like Phil and Lil as Reptar are just like walking around having fun being babies but smashing things because they're also a dinosaur. So this is a baby dinosaur.
The monster begins to march towards the officers, making them flee as the monster's foot comes down, crushing a mailbox, a streetlight, and the police cars, which causes gasoline to leak out of them. The monster then wreaks havoc through the city, destroying a train station and damaging various buildings. One lady needed the dinosaur pointed out to her before she screamed and ran. That got a good chuckle out of all of us. Back at the Daily Planet, Perry White tells Clark that he'd better get on over to the museum to see if Lois is all right. Clark goes into a closet and changes into Superman, then hurries over to the museum and rescues Lois from the rubble. He tells her to go back to the Daily Planet building where she'll be safe, but she's not doing that.
Which he should know by now. We're like, how many episodes in for these shorts?
Like 4 or 5 at this point, yeah. But no, it's totally understandable.
Yeah, this is one of the episodes where Superman can't fly. He just jumps good. So he jumps good from building to building, with the monster approaching a dam that is neighboring a small town. The monster destroys a dam, flooding it while crushing some houses underfoot.
All those people are dead. They're super dead.
Yeah, Superman throws a giant boulder to fill the gap, and he's just like, good enough.
Soft.
The monster continues its rampage through a lake, marching towards a suspension bridge where some police officers and some tugboats are trying to take it down with some water hoses, and they're doing their best. The monster breaks through the suspension bridge, a very rubbery suspension bridge, endangering several motorists. Superman catches the falling bridge and ties it back together because he doesn't have his heat vision to do welds yet. As the monster approaches a nearby baseball stadium, Superman uses one of the bridge cables to trip it. As the monster falls, it crushes cars in another gas station. While the monster's tied up on the ground, Lois stands by to take a picture, with the monster's head falling right next to her. He tries to eat her, and the Superman flies into the monster's mouth and takes Lois out, telling her to stay put this time. Then pins the monster over a lamppost, and the city is saved. Later on at the Daily Planet, Lois and Clark are discussing the article Lois wrote about the monster, which states that the monster is being held at the Metropolis Zoo. I'm not sure how. Clark says to Lois, "You showed plenty of courage getting that monster story." And Lois quotes, "Thanks, but where were you?" Clark goes, "Me? Oh, I must have fainted."
Huzzah. I think this episode probably had the highest death count.
Oh, easily.
Yeah.
I just also thought it was just interesting, too, that it's, like, 12 years before the first Godzilla movie came out in 54, so it's kind of cool to see, like, a kaiju-type battle in this story as opposed to, you know, what kind of continues going on with, like, you know, his classic villains.
Yeah, it also predates the Beast from 10,000 Fathoms by about 9 years.
Oh, yeah, right.
Post King Kong, though.
That's true.
Oh, and also post The Lost World, obviously.
Right.
All right, the story for this one is by Bill Turner and Ted Pierce. Hey, he's a Looney Tunes guy.
Woo!
It is directed by Dave Fleischer and actually directed by William Bowski and Ruben Grossman. The story mines a familiar trope in the sci-fi pulps, the dinosaur that is discovered encased in ice and goes on a rampage once it thaws out. This was tried and true and well-worn even in the 1940s. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's 1912 adventure novel The Lost World popularized dinosaurs in modern fiction, but Jules Lemire beat him to the punch with 1910's Panic in Paris. To the best of our knowledge, that's the earliest known story where frozen dinosaurs warm up and decide to go on a stroll through a major city. You'll notice that Superman is still hopping about in this one, as I already said. The Fleischers thought that this looked silly in animation and asked the comic book people if they could just have Superman fly. The radio show was also keen on this, so Superman's ability to leap tall buildings in a single bound soon became flight. The first two shorts we talked about, Superman's flying around like a motherfucker in those.
Yeah, the inconsistency is really funny.
Alright, and this brings us to the collapse of Fleischer Studios. Mr. Bug Goes to Town was released on December 5th, 1941, and was dead on arrival. Even retrospective reviews were like, I want to like this one, but no, this is a bad movie. Paramount, who had lent a great deal of money to the Fleischers to cover their move to Florida to avoid unionizing, called in the tab. Dave and Max, unable to reconcile their differences, come up with the money, or fight back against Paramount in any way, were forced out of their own company, hoisted by their own petards, by my perspective at least.
Hmm.
Paramount absorbed all of Fleischer Studios' assets and most of their staff. They asked Nitel, who was Max's son-in-law, if he was going to be loyal to his father, and he's like, "No, I'm loyal to my paycheck. I'm going with you guys." They rebranded their new subsidiary as Famous Studios, which is what Paramount started out as to begin with. They already had the name copywritten, so that helped them save some money. The first 9 Fleischer shorts were actually supervised by the Fleischers. The remaining 8 were produced by Famous Studios, but animation nerds tend to informally label the whole kit and caboodle as the Fleischer Superman. That's what I've been doing so far. The Fleischer and Famous shorts maintain the same animation quality for the most part, and they have the same cast and crew, so unless you're actually looking for Fleischer or Famous in the logos, it's pretty consistent. The main difference between Fleischer and Famous, however, there is one stark difference, is that the Fleischer shorts stick to standard pulp sci-fi plots. With Famous, we start seeing war propaganda. This is starkly this is starkly demonstrated by the first Famous Studios Superman short. I don't know if I want to say this out loud. Japators. It's a portmanteau of saboteur and Japanese, or possibly shortened to a racial slur for the Japanese.
This one has not aged particularly well, which is sad because it has stunning animation in it.
Yeah, you mentioned that cigarette burn transition. That was a really good transmit.
Well, I mean, like I was telling you prior to the podcast about like the text and stuff like that too, it is very interesting to see the subject matter drastically change to mostly propaganda or weirder things, I guess, for lack of better words.
Yeah, I mean, Pearl Harbor happened while the Fleischer shorts were in the middle of the production, and the Famous ones were made after Pearl Harbor, so I think it probably would have gone in that direction regardless, but still, it is a very stark dividing line.
Yeah.
The story begins with a shot of the front page of the Daily Planet, with the headline reading, "The World's Largest Bombing Plane Finally Completed." The man reading the newspaper is Japanese, and he stands up and looks at a picture of the Statue of Liberty in his office, then pushes a button on his desk and changes the picture into one of the Imperial Japanese flag. And the music starts going into that pseudo Asian, but actually from a minstrel show about the Arabian Nights motif.
Yeah.
Also, like, we're saying this character is Japanese. You can imagine what a Japanese caricature in the 40s looks like. He does not look like a Japanese man.
We'll be getting into that more in a bit. This man bows to it and jams his glowing cigarette into the news headline, which sets up that beautiful transition that Sylvan pointed out already. Later, the Japanese man and some acquaintances hit a guard as the plane is being loaded for a test run. Lois and Clark are taking a tour of the new bombing plane for the planet. When everyone is told to get off, Lois very characteristically stays behind and hides in a locker on board the plane. Damn. Fucking Lois. As the plane takes off, we see that there are other stowaways aboard. Hidden inside what looks like the bombs are the Japanese men, who still have their hats on. The spies tie and gag the pilots and hijack the plane to take it to Tokyo, presumably to reverse engineer it. Meanwhile, Lois emerges from her hiding place and moves over to the cockpit. As she's about to open the door, she notices that the Japanese spies have hijacked the plane. She sneaks into the room and calls for help on the radio, but the spy sees her and responds to her.
Of course he does. She's not even remotely hiding.
In her calls for help, the fighter planes are sent out to stop the hijackers, but the hijackers deploy a bomb, which stops the fighters from taking off. Clark Kent then decides that this is the moment to go into an elevator and change it to Superman.
Taking his sweet time as always.
Superman enters the plane and to stop the hijackers, but one of them has Lois tied up and is ready to drop her out of the plane through the bomb hatch. Superman jumps out of the plane and comes back through the bomb hatch to save Lois as she is being dropped. He unties her and starts fighting the hijackers. One of them breaks the plane's controls and the plane starts falling towards the city. Superman takes Lois out of the plane and places her on the ground, then flies back up and catches the plane, bringing it to a safe landing right into the middle of the street. And that is a very dynamic rescue scene that is often referenced or replicated, particularly in Superman media. Brandon Routh lands a plane in a very memorable sequence in the, I would say, very uneven Superman Returns.
Yeah.
Although a lot of people are very kind to Superman Returns, considering that Zack Snyder was up next.
Yeah, I was about to say I'm one of those people. I actually enjoy Superman Returns.
And the CW Supergirl show also has a sequence where she lands a plane in a very similar fashion.
The Supergirl show is actually very cute.
I'm sure I would get into it, but I don't know. I'm terrible at keeping up with TV. This short has a story by Bill Turner and Carl Meyer. It was directed by Seymour Nightell, our old pal, but it was actually directed by Myron Waldman and Nicholas Tafuri. Famous Studios kept the whole, the credited director is actually more of a supervisor, and the key animators do most of the actual grunt work of directing. This one does not bear the Famous Studios logo, as the studio had just ousted the Fleischers and was still reorganizing and moving everything back to New York during production. Another thing that Sylvan and I touched upon in the car is that, yes, moving your facilities over to Florida for tax reasons is a thing, and also it is easier to find non-union talent there, but finding consistent talent is tough. Florida has spent decades trying to make itself into a second Broadway or a second Hollywood, and it has not done a great job. The closest they ever came was the Nickelodeon Studios in Florida, and that fell apart after like 10-15 years. Yes, you can get non-union labor, but nobody's gonna leave their cushy Hollywood job to hang out in Orlando for half the pay and no protections or benefits. And
especially not lately.
Yeah, I don't think DeSantis is doing anything to help that matter. Superman was first depicted as attacking the Axis by the Axis powers themselves. I was surprised to learn this. Playing off the Jewish heritage of Superman's creators, the official newspaper of the SS featured Superman assaulting the German West Wall in one of their issues.
Woof.
Woodrow Wilson actively and enthusiastically funded propaganda campaigns during America's involvement in World War I. Birth of a Nation was funded by the government for propaganda purposes, which just makes that even worse.
Yeah, I was gonna say, ooh.
This received some backlash even in those days from people who felt that it was unethical for governments to try to manipulate the public in such a way. As the 20s and 30s marched along, overt propaganda became associated with communism and fascism, both of which were out of fashion in the liberal democracy of the United States. As such, the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration was reluctant to re-engage in propaganda after Pearl Harbor, but they relented when media conglomerates and advertising firms began making inquiries and offers. The United States set up propaganda operations under the euphemism of providing war information. animation was often dismissed as kiddie fair before this, but the United States Army didn't seem to think so, moving 500 troops into Walt Disney Studios the day after Pearl Harbor to work on propaganda cartoons, and it remained there for the duration of the war, probably one of the only reasons that Disney didn't go bankrupt during that period. Japa Tours plays into many common tropes of American World War II propaganda, with the most prominent being its depiction of Japanese people as grotesque, uncivilized, and subhuman enemies who are fanatical to the point of embracing death. The purpose of these depictions was to convince the American public that a thorough destruction of Japan, up to and including mass slaughter of Japanese civilians, was a necessary step in ending the war. I think it's also rather telling in that opening sequence, our saboteur is a Japanese person living as an immigrant in the United States, and he's just waiting for his opportunity to strike, a way to rationalize Japanese internment. Interestingly enough, early caricatures of Japanese troops infantilized them as nearsighted buck-toothed dopes who were tricked into attacking Pearl Harbor by the Nazis. As the war went on, Japanese soldiers and civilians were shown as evil, vermin-like imperialists instead. Pretty rich for the United States to depict Japan as imperialists. Like, no fair, we conquered Hawaii first. Okay, and then the next one we're talking about...
It gets better!
Yeah, I was going to say, quicker speaking, it's worse.
Jungle Drums. If you're familiar with animation before, you know, the 1960s, you pretty much know where we're going here. Deep in the African jungle, a tribe of mostly enshrouded in shadow aboriginal warriors are having a celebration. Their leader is a tall man in a white cloak. Secretly, he's a Nazi commander, and the tribe's sacred temple is actually an underground Nazi outpost.
For reasons.
Yeah, they're masquerading as some kind of cult leader in order to pacify the natives, you know, getting back to infantilizing non-white people. The Nazis eagerly await the arrival of an American convoy with information about an Allied attack. When a military plane flies overhead, the Nazis shoot it down. And
Lois is there for reasons.
Yeah, the commander sends his warriors to search for the survivors. At the wreck site, the mortally wounded lieutenant hands the secret documents to the crew's only survivor, Lois Lane, who's there for reasons. He tells her to destroy the documents and then dies. Lois does not do this, and she's caught by the natives and tied up. She frees herself for just long enough to run into the jungle and hide the documents under a rock. She is then captured and brought back to the temple for interrogation, where she is tied to a chair. When she refuses to talk, the commander orders the Aborigine warriors to burn her at the stake. Meanwhile, Clark Kent and another pilot are flying out to meet with Lois's convoy. They spot the wrecked plane not far from the village. Clark parachutes down to investigate, and once on the ground, he changes into Superman, while some less anthropomorphized vultures get a free peep show. He flies to the village as Lois is already being burned at the stake, with the commander watching her. He says that I can stop this if you tell me where the papers are, but then one of the warriors found the papers, and he's like, oh, never mind.
And one of the most cringeworthy parts of the whole episode kind of happens while she's being burned at the stake. Because that, like, the aboriginal face is just coming through the screen.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. We get superimpositions of a particular warrior with a bone through his nose.
Yeah.
You've never seen anything so creatively and technically well drawn while being so disgusting and horrible. You're like, wow, this is impressively awful. Because, like, even by old-timey cartoon racism, like, this is just next level.
Overjoyed with his success, the commander has his men radio headquarters and send the Nazi U-boats to attack the Allied fleet. At this point, I should point out that everyone who's voicing the bad guys, I think their direction is like, hey, do you know how to do a German accent? And they're like, yeah, sure, here, I'll do it. And he's like, yeah, it's close enough, whatever, go ahead. Superman arrives and saves Lois from burning to death. When the warriors see a man who can walk through fire, they run in terror. The Nazi soldiers fight back against Superman to no avail. Meanwhile, Lois takes a spare white cloak and sneaks in to use the radio. The commander catches her, notices her high-heeled shoe underneath that white cloak, but before he can do anything about it, Superman comes to her rescue. She sends a message to the American headquarters warning them about the Nazi subs. Out at sea, the Nazi U-boats prepare to decimate the Allied fleet, but before they can attack, they are bombed by a squadron of B-26 bombers sent in response to Lois's warnings. The subs are destroyed, and the Allied fleet is saved. Meanwhile, in Berlin, during a thunderstorm, Adolf Hitler listens to a newsflash about the defeat of the U-boat force in English. Angered, he flips a switch on the radio and hangs his head in frustration and despondency as the propaganda song "Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition" is heard. Alright, so for this one, the story was by Jay Morton and Robert Little. It was directed by Dan Gordon and actually directed by Orestes Calpini and H.C. Ellison. Here, I'm going to bring up the rubber hose technique.
Daddy, come on.
Early cartoons were animated with what became known as the rubber hose technique. Short on time and low on budget and with little history to draw upon, the first professional animators would render their characters in a simple, minimal style that was easy to replicate through hundreds of drawings. Bill Nolan, who was tasked with streamlining Felix the Cat, hit upon the idea of giving his figures curved limbs instead of arms and legs with realistic joints. Having Felix's arms bend like a rubber hose saved time and also allowed for surreal exaggerated gags. After Felix blew up, most of the other studios followed suit, especially Fleischer. Rubber hose declined by the end of the 1930s as animators honed, polished, and made innovations in their craft. Fleischer has virtually no rubber hose in the Superman shorts, with notable exceptions of, say, collapsing buildings, the vultures, and the African people in this cartoon.
Yeah, I was gonna say that. Notably stood out, though, for technical reasons, not just the racist ones.
Portraying black people as superstitious, childlike, savage, and simian was typical in American media at the time. I don't know if using rubber hose was a conscious decision on the part of famous here, but it wasn't coincidental. Much of the humor in rubber hose animation evolved directly from blackface performances in vaudeville, medicine, and minstrel shows. You know, as is frequently pointed out, the main reason why Mickey Mouse and most of his successors have white gloves is because it stands out from the background, but that does have a heritage in 19th century minstrel shows. That is where that narrative shorthand arises from, and when somebody saw gloves like that in the 1930s, they expected a certain type of portrayal in that character.
Most of the early rubber hose characters were either animals associated with negative African caricatures, or in the face of Bosco, the little no longer socially acceptable N-word boy.
Yeah.
Like, actually that.
Well, he was originally called Bosco the Talk Ink Kid. He climbed out of an ink bottle like Coco the Clown, but that being said, in his first short, he is talking with that minstrel affect. So yeah, there's no way around it. And when Bosco shows up on Tiny Toons, he's depicted as a little dog boy.
Yeah.
And yeah, whenever we talk about this sort of thing, reactionary people who would rather bury the past than examine it will point out, like, well, you know, things were different then, people didn't know any better, and there were a lot of people who did things out of ignorance, but these type of depictions didn't come out of a vacuum, and they did have a purpose, and there were people back then in the groups being denigrated that knew what it meant. One thing that I like to bring up that is superhero relevant is Superman's competitor, Captain Marvel. In his 1940s comics, there were minstrel type portrayals of African people, particularly a riverboat captain. Mm-hmm. And then one day, the publishers of Captain Marvel got letters from black school children who kept telling them about how hurtful it was that their favorite superhero interacted with black people in that capacity. And the editors were shamed into dropping that and then drawing black people like they were people from here on out. So, yeah, this stuff has always meant what it did.
Very much so. I mean, as a person of color myself, it is kind of cringy to see some of these stereotypes, especially with the Japatora one, because I get often mistaken as a Far East Asian, so it is kind of strange to kind of see those types of depictions even today as looking through that lens as well, too, and then obviously with this one as well, too. It's really subtle, too, so it almost looks like the racism is actually, like, getting bigger and bigger towards the end, because you see them as those black figurines, and I didn't remember them being that objectively clear at the end of the short the first time I watched this when I was a kid. But
oh yeah, they're silhouettes at first, and then as it progresses, you start to actually see details of them until suddenly they're flying at your face.
Yeah, which is like, I remember the ending, but I didn't remember how, like, turn up the dial the racism kind of went through that whole short. That was, yeah, that was kind of hard to watch, I'm not gonna lie.
going through World War II propaganda for this podcast, I went through a bunch of them, and including Dr. Seuss's editorial cartoons, which I was fascinated by when that first compilation book was released when I was in high school. And one thing that stuck out for me even then was that when Dr. Seuss did caricatures of the Axis powers, he did Hitler, Mussolini, and a Japanese man. He didn't do Tojo or Hirohito, it was just a generic Japan, because none of them were human enough to have an individual character element, I guess. Alright, the final one that we are talking about is The Underground World.
I'd say this was the weakest one of the night.
Yeah, I agree.
A local scientist, Dr. Henderson, comes to the Daily Planet with a proposition for Perry White. Several decades earlier, Dr. Henderson's father discovered a series of caverns that he named the Henderson Caves. Modest gentleman. The elder Dr. Henderson explored the caves for several years before he mysteriously disappeared. Now, the younger Dr. Henderson would like to go back into the caverns and actually catalog them. And he would like the Daily Planet to fund the expedition in exchange for Kent and Lois getting an exclusive on it. Mr. White agrees after Lois elbows him a bit. She thinks it's going to be exciting. Several days later, Lois, Clark, and Dr. Henderson are at the entrance of the Henderson Caves, ready to go spelunking. The caverns are part of a river system, so the only way into the caverns is by boat. Lois and Dr. Henderson take the first boat, and Clark follows soon afterwards. They bring some dynamite in order to excavate if they need to, and we get lots of pointed close-ups, so, you know, it's going to be relevant later.
We'll come back later.
Yes, it will. Come inside, it's fun inside. Inside the cave, Lois and Dr. Henderson row into a large grotto. They dock on the side of the river, but once they step out, the boat drifts off down the river. Henderson is not good at his job. The sack of dynamite in the boat is accidentally ignited and causes an explosion that Clark, who is just entering the caverns, can hear outside. In my head, Clark's thinking, ah, fucking Lois again.
I think he even has that expression too at that point as well.
Yeah.
For once, though, it wasn't her.
Yeah.
For once. Sensing danger, Clark paddles faster.
Sensing danger. It's not that surprising.
In between, Dr. Henderson and Lois have been captured by a race of hawk people living in the caverns.
So I don't need to see this happen. You know, it's not important to the storytelling for us to see them show up.
Yeah, they're not hinted at.
This is specifically the one where we were like, so they just don't give us any plot. I'm really interested to hear if there's any kind of background.
This was
there isn't any. Those hawk people are not from Thanagar. Yeah, they're not teased. They're not insinuated. There isn't a shot where with like Lois, Clark, and Henderson approaching the caves, and like a hawk person is watching them in the distance or anything. It's just smash cut to Lois and Henderson being captured by the hawk people. We don't even see them apprehended. Henderson and Lois are brought to their king, and they see a statue of Dr. Henderson's father just above the king's throne. Neither of them understand why the Hawkmen have a statue like that or where they got it, but the king gives them a clue when he signals them to be tied to a stone slab and then lowered into some molten metal.
I missed this part, so I kept waiting for the explanation of why they made a statue of the dad.
Whereas we see, like, Lois looks down at the boiling metal, looks at the statue, and then her face. That's a good shot. It's a shame you missed it.
I'd say I'd go back and rewatch it, but I think I'm good.
As Clark enters the cave, he sees Lois and Dr. Henderson being lowered into the liquid, and at that point, Clark changes into Superman and starts fighting through the army of Hawkmen. Once he's finished with them, he saves Lois and Henderson and wastes no time in getting them out of the cave. The Hawkmen chase after them, but Superman uses some dynamite to cover the entrance of the cave with rubble. Back at the Daily Planet, Perry White is impressed by Lois and Clark's story, but since they gathered no evidence of the Hawk people, he burns the article because, you know, that's nonsense. This is actually a very good issue of Astro City, where they go into the editor of the major metropolitan newspaper in the superhero-filled city in his first story, and he goes into all the fantastical events that happened to him, but because he just doesn't have any first-hand knowledge or sources, it's just him reporting on, there was a minor power failure at a train station, because the editor is like, yeah, okay, so there was an extra-dimensional attack from an alien tyrant. You got an interview with the superhero who stopped it? I'm sorry, I got nothing to work on here, pal.
I just love the fact that they also funded the expedition too, so they also like just lost whatever investment on that trip as well.
The story for The Underground World was by Jay Morton, and
didn't do a good job.
most of the others had two credited writers, so yeah, that might have been the issue. This was directed by Seymour Nitell again. The actual directing was by Ruben Grossman and Nicholas DeFurry. This is the penultimate short and Lois's last appearance in the Superman series. The plot is a riff on the subterranean fantasy tale, first prominent in the late 17th century due to Pierre Bourdieu's pseudoscientific hollow earth theory. One of the earliest examples of this is Ludwig Holberg's 1741 novel Niels Klim's Underground Travels. Jules Verne's 1864 novel Journey to the Center of the Earth is the most famous example, but the underground world borrows most of its aesthetic from Edgar Rice Burroughs' 1914 pulp adventure At the Earth's Core. Burroughs later wrote a crossover where Tarzan visited this particular hollow earth, and Superman's battle with the bird people is essentially this Tarzan novel with Superman switched in. I think that's why it feels very much not like a Superman story, even though this is still a proto-Superman that hasn't quite fully formed yet. Like, there's still a lot of Burroughs stink on him, a lot of preceding Doc Samson Tarzan type all over this one.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it doesn't feel like a Superman story because it's not a Superman story, is what you're saying.
Yeah, he's Tarzan with a cape in this one. I thought we'd talk a little bit about the cast for this one. First was Bud Collier as Superman. He was also Superman on the radio show.
He just runs around the caves yelling Lois for a while. That's like most of the episode.
Sylvan was surprised at how understated his delivery was. Like, even the whole, this is a job for Superman, it's he's just kind of
this
saying
it.
This
is a job for Superman. Like, he sounds like he's on some kind of anti-anxiety drug and he doesn't fully need it anymore. So he sounds a little doped up.
Yeah, like a beta blocker. Yeah, it definitely sounded like he filled it in most of the lines.
Once again, this is a Superman that doesn't have a Parasite or a Metallo or his true arch nemesis Batman, so yeah, none of the villains really threaten him. He's kind of bored, maybe.
He doesn't sort of like, sound it.
Sort of like Willem Dafoe and Aquaman.
Anyways, Collier, besides Superman, is best known for hosting the very early TV game shows Beat the Clock and To Tell the Truth. He was also a Sunday school teacher, which feels like a very appropriate thing for a Superman actor to be.
Honestly, that sounds on character.
There's a lot of cute footage I saw of him, like, interviewing people on the game show, and he's always visibly flustered with joy whenever the contestant says that they plan to donate some of their winnings to charity.
Aww.
Like, oh, look at Superman. Then we have Joan Alexander as Lois Lane. She was also Lois on the radio show, and she voiced Lois in the 1966 Filmation cartoon.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, she was my favorite character from the whole short series.
She gets the best lines in this, and, I mean, Lois is consistent in the flinging herself into danger in order to get a story element. As Sylvan pointed out, this is often a point of ridicule in the 40s and a point of admiration in the 80s.
I think Lois is probably the most interesting aspect of the Superman mythos to me, and that's because it shows a lot of how different generations feel about gender roles, because, like, oh, the 60s stuff is brutal to Lois in making her out to be just an incompetent bimbo with masculine tendencies that are not suited for a woman of her place.
Yes and no. What I find interesting is that a lot of people mock the Lois has no idea that Clark is Superman thing. I even remember, like, Dana Delaney, the voice actress for Superman, the animated series. She compared their relationship to Eros and Psyche.
Yeah.
Throughout the 1960s, Lois is constantly suspicious that Clark Kent is Superman and comes up with increasingly more elaborate Rube Goldberg scenarios to trick him into revealing himself, and Superman just has to go to further and further depths of deception in order to get her off the trail. He has Batman dress up as him, but then Lois figures out, hey, Superman's friends with Batman. That might have been Batman in a costume. And then Superman builds a bunch of Superman robots to walk around so he and Clark can be seen at the same time. But then she becomes aware of the Superman robots, and then Clark has to work around that. It just gets more and more, and it's silly, and I love it.
Yeah, I love the hokiness of it. It's just interesting to see her as, like, I don't know if dynamic character is necessarily the right word, and I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn when I say this, but for someone that isn't supposed to be taken seriously, like, whenever she gives out orders, like, say, to the U.S. military for the U-boats or trying to hide those papers, like, she is kind of accepted as an authority figure.
half of the time. The other half of the time, she is kind of like the damsel in distress trope. I just find that interesting that, like, the whole dichotomy of, like, is she completely useless or not is kind of, like, at the writer's whim here.
It fluctuates almost as much as Superman's powers in this.
Yeah.
But, yeah, in the 90s, Lois morphs into... She knows that Clark is Superman, but she's kind of waiting for him to feel comfortable enough to tell him, like, you know, the parent of a gay child. And that seems to be everybody's favorite form of Lois. And, yeah, that is the one that's the more fair to both of them and cast neither of them in a deceptive liar light. I remember in All-Star Superman, when Superman reveals his identity to Lois, it takes her a couple issues to get used to it because he's like, oh, you spent our entire relationship lying to me.
Yeah.
I'm not cool with that. Especially all those times I tried to get you to demonstrate that you actually are Clark and you refused to go along with it and come clean. I'm gonna need to work on this.
Well, to be fair, that was one of my favorite subplot lines from that whole story.
Oh, in general, if we're talking about modern iterations of Superman, I'd say All-Star Superman is the gold standard. That's the one to beat.
I agree. Shall discuss that one.
Alexander was a panelist on the 1950s game show The Name's the Same, but spent most of her later years marrying and divorcing a series of incredibly rich men.
Good for her.
I was going to say good for her.
Yeah. And the last voice actor I'm going to talk about is Jackson Beck as the narrator. He was also Perry White in a number of the shorts, and also was the narrator in Perry White on the 1966 Filmation Superman show. This guy is a voiceover lifer. He has a very long IMDb page, and the IMDb page is like, this is incomplete, we don't have everything.
Uh-oh.
He did old commercials in the 1930s and then parodies of his old commercials on Saturday Night Live in the 70s. One of his later credits was the narrator of the 1980s G.I. Joe cartoon, which feels like a full circle thing for me because the Superman stuff feels like it came from a very long time ago in a different era, and the 80s G.I. Joe is my childhood, and this guy was present for both of those things.
Fantastic. You can really hear the old-timiness in his voice, too. Right. You know, as soon as you brought it up that he had like a huge IMDb credit, I can almost remember just about like a bunch of random things that he just happens to be into.
Yeah, the first thing that shows up on his resume is Bluto, by the way. All right, that brings me to the end of Fleischer Superman. I mean, the end of Fleischer Superman is when Fleischer was absorbed into Paramount, but you know what I mean. By 1943, exhibitors were noticeably less enthusiastic about the Superman series. Having gone through the expense of moving the Fleischer crew back to New York and rebranding the company as Famous Studios, Paramount was balking at the substantial price tag for the Superman shorts. As I said already, most of these shorts cost $30,000 per episode, which is much higher than any other short, even the Disney ones. They replaced Superman with a different licensed comics character, Little Lulu. In 1947, when Paramount got tired of paying fees and royalties to Lulu creator Marjorie Henderson Bell, they replaced that series with one starring the knockoff character, Little Audrey. Famous began producing Popeye shorts in Technicolor starting in 1943, and their newer characters abandoned the ribald humor, surreal visuals, and technical innovations of the Fleischer era, skewing towards kiddie fare with characters like Baby Huey, Casper the Friendly Ghost, and Herman and Catnip. The studio was profitable until it closed its doors in 1967, but animation nerds don't think too highly of it, comparing it negatively to Fleischer, as well as Disney, Warner Brothers, MGM, and UPA. In its final year, Ralph Bakshi was put in charge of Famous. Paramount shuttered it while he was getting used to his chair. He vented his frustrations into Fritz the Cat. The rights to the Superman cartoons reverted to National DC Comics in 1947. Nobody at DC bothered to renew the copyrights in the late 1960s, which I don't know if this is a coincidence, but this is roughly around the time that DC Comics and Warner Brothers was being acquired by a mafia-backed parking garage company.
What?
That, I did not know that one.
I missed that story.
Yeah, I was about to say, that sounds like a really fun fact.
Oh, yeah. The messiness of Warner Brothers in the immediate wake of Jack Warner's retirement is a whole story. And yes, I assumed that Warner Brothers bought DC at some point, but no, both of them were bought by this mafia-backed parking garage company, and DC Comics was bought first.
That's amazing.
So, like, that's not a euphemism, right? You really mean that it's a parking garage company.
Yeah, parking garage company that had mob ties. It was like a front for the mob.
That's fantastic.
I love the idea of a mafia-backed Superman.
DC still owns the ancillary rights to, like, you know, Prince Fleischer Superman merchandise, as well as the physical film. Warner Brothers put out a lovely 4K Blu-ray restoration of the Fleischer Superman in 2023, in fact, but the shorts are in the public domain, and therefore have shown up on a multitude of cheap, poorly composited VHS and DVD releases. Being millennials, this is how we were first exposed to them. When I first got this DVD that we watched, I was like, wow, these are really pretty. And
it's nice just to be able to hear what they're saying, too.
And subtitles.
All right, and that brings us to themes. I texted back and forth with Carlos about, you know, what we wanted to talk about in the thematic segments of this, and Carlos asked permission to talk about socio-political underpinnings, which is an adorable thing to phrase to us. You were afraid that we'd balk at getting political with Superman.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where, like, in my normal day-to-day life as a finance bro, you know, it's very much, my political leanings are very much fundamentally opposed to what I do for work. And then also in the space of athletics I participated, it's all MAGA people and Trumpists, and I can't be any further away from that, too. So it's just one of those things where I'm not used to talking about politics so openly.
Yeah, you're like, is it okay if we talk about Superman through a Marxist film lens, get into dialectical materialism? And it's like, oh, we getting Marxist as fuck, Carlos, it's fine.
Like I said, it was just very, I know it sounds silly now considering that who I'm hanging out with, but it's just one of those things. I'm just not used to having these types of discussions. You know?
Ryan texted me specifically to say that it was very adorable.
We're like, oh, Carlos.
Yeah, I appreciate it. No, I know, and it's really funny, too, because I have, like, listened to a few of the other episodes. I know that these tend to go into rabbit holes as well, too, so. I just figured I'd just ask and be, you know, naive.
Well, also, before you broached that subject, I asked if you were comfortable with talking about the racism, and you were like, no, that's fine.
Yeah.
In fact, it might be, I would say, an act of cowardice to talk about 1940 Superman and deliberately avoid talking about the more uncomfortable elements of it, and also the quasi-socialist elements of Superman. I do know that there are people out there who prefer a more shallow reading of the media that they consume, and they don't want to place it in its context amongst the people who made it and the times that they lived it in and all of that stuff, but that's not what we do. And if anybody is not cool with that, I doubt they're listening at this point.
No, that's true. Very valid things to say.
All right, our first rabbit hole is Superman's transition from quasi-socialist champion of the oppressed to upkeeper of the status quo. Modern conservatives, and conservatives of the time, routinely labeled Franklin Delano Roosevelt a socialist for his New Deal policies, especially when they're trying to gin up outrage in favor of abolishing Social Security. A lot of that been happening lately. American conservatives have gained a lot of ground and still them over, they're just trying to see how much they can get away with. Actual socialists, then and now, interpret Roosevelt as an oligarchical capitalist who strove to preserve hegemony by tossing a few basic concessions to the working class before they got fed up and brought out the guillotines. I personally consider this to be an incredibly accurate assessment of the New Deal.
Yes, I would wholeheartedly agree with the socialist perspective from that one.
Yeah, when I was in eighth grade, I did a project on FDR, and I was like, oh, wow, this man is really fascinating. He came up with some really great ideas, and then I got to the internment camps, and I was like, oh.
I mean, I do think it's better to have Social Security than to not have it.
Oh, I mean, who are we kidding? There's not going to be any Social Security by the time we get to have it.
None of the reactionary goons have their way, yeah. Social Security does not end stratification or fix income inequality. Certainly doesn't now. We have worse income inequality than the Gilded Age or pre-revolutionary France. The means of production remain in control of a handful of robber barons. Roosevelt saw to that. But, as Marx put it, if some populist facet of counterculture catches on with the people, the bourgeois will try to appropriate it. Most conservative slogans and buzzwords are nakedly pilfered from the left, after all. That is why the libertarians here call themselves libertarians, although I think anarcho-capitalists are the more hilarious of the ones who are trying to use, like, rebellious leftist slogans
it's really funny
argue in favor of hegemony.
Well, it's completely off topic. But just the fact that Argentina just elected a self-proclaimed anarcho-capitalist is the funniest thing, and also very terrifying, because he's like Argentinian Trump meets Bolsonaro meets a literal clown, because he was like plays a clown character on their version of CNN, and it's just really funny the use of language that he uses, and then his policies are just disgustingly funny.
The first picture I saw of this man after he got elected president of Argentina was him dressed up as a libertarian superhero, like a red and black porcupine man.
Yeah, almost like a black and red Batman, because he got like the weird cape. He's kind of doing like the Batman like kind of stance with the hands out a little bit. It was very weird.
Like, but how bad is this going to get? Is he going to be Bolsonaro or is he going to be Pinochet?
He's too inept to be Pinochet, but he's definitely going to probably be worse than Bolsonaro, because he's trying to do similar governmental policies that Argentina did like 25 years ago by trying to attempt to have their Argentinian dollar match the U.S. dollar. So they're going to buy a lot of U.S. dollars, and it's just going to cause everybody that's poor to starve in the streets. It's not a very successful way of going about with the economy, amongst other things, because he wants to remove every single government safety net from day one. Like, as soon as he's in office, he wants to get rid of their version of Social Security and every other government good that the Argentine government is supposed to offer to the people.
Well, on the other hand, Milton Friedman and Kissinger are both dead, so they can't massage things for him. There's that,
among other
things. I mean, their idiot successors are probably going to take a crack at it, but you know.
Absolutely.
Anyways, back on topic. Superman is an example of this appropriation. Comic-savvy folk are already aware that early Superman was the brainchild of working-class Jewish kids in the big city, whether it's Cleveland, Toronto, or New York. Those cities like to argue over which one of them is the real metropolis. Superman's formative adventures reek of power fantasies dreamed up by a person struggling during the Depression. That is why I'm really fascinated by early Superman. I read through them and was like genuinely entertained. I wasn't just interested in them as like somebody who likes social history. I was like, wow, this has so much fuck you charisma to it.
Yeah.
Superman just busts up lynch mobs, goes after war profiteers, he bullies landlords, he's like, charge your tenants fair rent, fix that fire trap, I will throw you off this building.
Pretty much.
I need to go back and read some of these.
Oh, I mean, that's kind of the reason why I re-fell in love with the character, because, you know, I think my favorite superhero ever is probably, you know, Peter Parker as Spider-Man, but like, but in terms of like the DC is, when I actually read those similar types of stories too, he literally is like a overpowered Spider-Man without the sense of humor, but in terms of being a superhero of the people, which is kind of like the real reason why I like him at the end of the day.
Like, that never wholly left the character. Yeah. Grant Morrison's New 52 relaunch of Superman was a very conscious attempt to get back to quasi-socialist 1938 Superman. But also, the Superman radio show exposed the Ku Klux Klan. Actually, it had a measurable effect on it. When Superman had that anti-Klan storyline, they used actual information about the Ku Klux Klan that make them look ridiculous, like they call their leader the Grand Cyclops and all that stuff. Yeah. And after that, Klan participation and membership declined steadily, and the Superman show had a definite effect on it. And also, Superman and the Mole Man, which was the character's first feature film, if you don't count the serials, nakedly preached against both xenophobia and racism when the Red Scare and the Civil Rights Movement was dominating headlines, and that was a ballsy move to make.
Yeah. I remember those panels to this day, too, where it's like, if you treat somebody differently than you, because they look differently than you, think differently than you, or believe in something differently than you, then you're equivocally un-American. And, like, at that time, even today, I mean, that's like, you don't, I would never see that in any sort of public discourse or media, to even have those types of panels on.
Yeah, I recently read Jean Luen Yang's Superman Smashes the Klan, which adapts the radio show.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, he's good.
And it's drawn by Gurihiro, which is a manga studio, but they're also using the clothing and character designs from the Fleischer, but it's also manga. It was really interesting looking. Also, I just love any time that Lois Lane wears a tie.
Same.
Getting back to Bruce Timm, when he was getting started on Superman the Animated Series, he said, like, you know, the Art Deco and the Fleischer stuff really worked for Batman, so his initial layouts just kept going with that. And he did very 1930s pulp versions of Brainiac and Lex Luthor and Lois Lane, but with his aesthetic too. And I do like the final version that he did, which is a little brighter, and he modeled after 1940s cruise ship ads. But yeah, I would be interested in seeing, like, Bruce Timm's 1930s Brainiac do something.
Oh, no, that'd be really cool. I mean, like you were saying, just, like, the whole universe between the two shows were fantastic. In terms of just the world building.
Now, still, the advent of World War II created an atmosphere that promoted patriotism, as we already covered. It was also frequently pushed that liberal democracy and not socialism was the only bastion against the rise of the fascists.
Which, I have a lot to say about that, but I don't want to make it too much of a political discussion since we're talking about Superman, but it is interesting to see that, because I always thought of fascism as almost as like the capitalism in decay type of thing, or in crisis, where it's like, you know, before there's any sort of actual reform, you tend to bring out the worst in you before you can actually like flip over and actually make progress.
Well, yeah, when we get to fascist governments, the ones that actually successfully seized power, such as in Italy and Germany, they were never popular with the people in a widespread way. Even when they were beating people in the streets, the Nazis never got more than 40% of the popular vote. They were able to seize power because they formed marriages of convenience with old guard conservative robber barons in the liberal democracies that preceded the fascists. And in a lot of ways, that's what's happening in the United States right now, and has already happened in, say, Hungary and Poland.
Yeah, I mean, I worked, I'm just going to bring up my places that I used to work at. It's really funny too, because I used to work at Braun Brothers and Harriman, which was like a financial firm that was started by the Bush family, and they were actually like Nazi sympathizers throughout the whole war, and they actually had to have a cease and desist to like have them stop lending them money for their war machine during the 30s, even after all U.S. trades were supposed to stop too. And then, you know, more famously with Ford having his factories over in Germany as well too, that they weren't allowed to bomb those factories as like military workers as well too. So it's really interesting to see those tidbits of like American fascist sympathizers still doing Nazi things even during and after the war.
Yeah, fascism isn't anti-capitalist. Yeah. The means of production is still held by private ownership under fascist dictatorships. The stratification remains. If anything, the Nazis are very on board with the stratification. They just want to be the ones at the top. But I think another thing that got rid of quasi-socialist Superman of 1938 was the establishment of the Comics Code in 1954-55. That pulled whatever was left of Superman's teeth by then. Throughout the 50s and 60s, Superman couldn't even punch his villains. Storytelling drama was instead generated through dramatic transformations, Superman being transformed into a lion or something, weird new colors of kryptonite, or yet another scheme by Lois to prove that Clark is actually Superman.
Or trying to trap him into marriage as well.
Yes. I find these stories to be charming, both in their imaginative milieu and general silliness, but they're definitely not kinetically transgressive as those 1930s Superman comics could often get. And something that Carlos wanted to bring up here was Superman as both an exemplar and sort of an undermining of the Nietzschean Übermensch. Would you like to expand on that?
I mean, the first coinage of the uses of Superman was because of the aspect Zarathustra. So it's just really interesting that, you know, you kind of have this idea of, you know, two working class Jewish writers coming up with the concept of Superman. You know, they have nothing to do with Nietzsche at all, but you see it being used by Hitler and Nazi Germany as well, too. But when we think of Overman or Above Man or Superman, you know, it's either this, like, transubstantiated, like, ideal of what it means to be human, and it's, like, literally exemplified in a DC character. So I always find it to be very weird that, like, you have the philosophical context of what it means to be a Superman, and then we have our own, like, DC creation, which is very different from that type of concept. So I always thought it was just very interesting that, you know, when I was reading through a lot of Western philosophy, keeping that in mind, I was like, you know, how do you not see the parallels, but also at the same time, like, you know, comic Superman is very different from what I would imagine most men reading Western philosophy would be thinking about in terms of their own view of what it means to be, like, an Superman.
Nietzsche lived in a time where scientific advancements were starting to pick up and Charles Darwin was doing his thing, and he was imagining a future where humanity would abandon religion and there would be a void there, and it needed to be filled with something else, because we needed something to ascribe to, something to believe in. If God is dead, then what do we do to replace God with? And Nietzsche's solution was the Übermensch. This was somebody who transcended ordinary morality and just became an exemplar, and he was one of the specials who would guide the foolish masses, the rest of us, towards a better tomorrow, away from our superstitious beginnings. And if you believe in a philosophy like this, and you ascribe to it, and you preach it to others, you're probably under the impression that one of those specials is you yourself.
Pretty much, yeah. It's a very red pill thing, I think, in terms of our age in 2023. But, you know, it's really funny, too, because, I mean, one of the names for even Superman is the Man of Tomorrow. So, and you've seen a lot of, like, say, the Man of Steel. I know everybody has their mixed opinions about it, but, you know, I always think of Superman's dad, like, when they're in the ship, you know, saying, like, pretty much preaching to them is, like, you can be the bridge of the gap between two peoples, and you can help them bridge to a better future in tomorrow. So even though it's not, you know, the darker version of Man of Steel, and for all the problems that it has, it still had that, like, that Nietzschean concept of being some sort of overman for the human race.
But I do think it's also a corruption of it, because Zack Snyder is a Randian,
yeah.
And Ayn Rand also believes that certain people are better than others, because she's a conservative. She believes in the stratification as much as anyone else who's conservative,
right.
And that the specials should guide society, and it would just be better for everyone if we got out of their way and let them do their thing. And of course, Rand believes that she herself was one of those specials. I think it's very interesting where Rand catches on with people who interpret superheroes, not only Zack Snyder, but Steve Ditko, who co-created Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. And at first blush, a Randian superhero seems like an oxymoron, because Randians think that altruism is evil, that if you help other people and build them up, you are teaching them to be parasitical, and that you need to do everything by yourself. So what are these superheroes for? But when you see these Randian superheroes, they don't care about helping people. They just care about punishing the wicked. And that is very much in Zack Snyder's Superman, because while Jor-El tells him to be a beacon for humanity to follow, Pa Kent is like, save them, or don't. Let them die. You don't owe them anything. You're better than them. And then when you get to the Steve Ditko, the more pure Steve Ditko characters that don't have Stan Lee reinterpreting them or in adding their dialogue, you got guys like The Question and Mr. A and Killjoy, who are just there to prove that they're better than everyone else, and also to preach Ayn Rand's virtues to the villains as they allow them to drown.
Yeah, it's, like I said, I just think it is quite the quagmire, but it is one of those things where I do think that having all these different, you know, if we're going to say, like, existentialism versus objectivism, because I think that's what Rand called her, philosophy, or I'm going to say, like, pseudo-philosophy, because I don't know if it's, like, a actual...
Only North American academics consider Ayn Rand a philosopher. Everyone else considers her a cult leader.
Yeah.
Because there's just so many inconsistencies in her theories and her applications of logic. And another thing is that, you know, when you're tying Nietzsche to fascism, just even a cursory glance at fascism realize that they're deliberately misinterpreting Nietzsche. As flawed as many of Nietzsche's concepts are, the Ubermensch is one or maybe a handful of specials. You cannot create an Ubermensch race.
Yeah.
Nietzsche would have been very much opposed to that, and also Nietzsche would probably have been opposed to, say, the mass slaughter of a whole lot of people that you've deemed degenerate and unworthy. Those things were attributed to Nietzsche, but by Nietzsche's sister, who survived him and was an ardent fascist, and deliberately distorted a number of his philosophies in order to sort of, like, make his stuff retrofit Nazism.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree with those statements as well, too. Yeah, because I think as soon as he died in 1900, I think she rewrote a bunch of his, like, original manuscripts to be used for propaganda later on, so it is interesting to kind of go back to the idea of propaganda, especially in these films, for... obviously different reasons, but it's really funny how you see all these different, the same themes, but being applied very differently throughout the last, 100 years?
Yeah, there is something fascistic and authoritarian in superhero fiction that is actually kind of a basic, sometimes cringeworthy criticism that has been leveled against them, especially since the Marvel movies took off and superheroes have become very dominant in discourse. And yeah, there's definitely ways to do that. Watchmen and The Dark Knight Returns both explored fascism, although I don't think The Dark Knight Returns did so intentionally. I think Frank Miller's just a bad storyteller.
I would second that one, too.
And yes, there is something about this character who they literally are might makes right, and they're able to bend the dictates of society because they are more powerful than us and they know better than us. There is a way to do effective fascist metaphors with that, hopefully in a bad way, to illustrate that it's bad, say in Watchmen, as opposed to that it's a good and necessary thing sometimes in order to keep degenerate hordes from overrunning our society and killing all the innocents, like, you know, Frank Miller likes to depict it.
Yeah.
Perhaps unintentionally, because, hang on, I don't think Frank Miller thinks his stuff through. But yeah, this isn't about fascist Batman, this is about Superman.
Yeah.
And more often than not, I think that, as Alan Moore would put it, the superhero applies best when you're using it as a conduit to expand your imagination, especially when you're a child. And also, the power fantasy can be flipped in order to create aspirations for people. When you think you're weak and downtrodden, you know, it's nice to have that figure to make you think that you're more special than people. people sometimes perceive you as. And this becomes doubly so when the superhero is shifted to take the form of marginalized groups. You know, Black Panther, Ms. Marvel, various queer heroes, the entirety of the X-Men.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the superheroes that we latched onto, the X-Men.
Gee, I wonder why.
Very fitting. No, I mean, I agree with that, too. And that's generally how I like to view Superman, too, is that sense of our aspirational figure. Although, like we've just been discussing for the past hour, like, his backstory is a little bit more complicated because, you know, it's not so... it's a lot easier to kind of turn him into, like, a fascistic type figure or a power of authority as opposed to somebody that's supposed to help the downtrodden. But
yeah, my favorite interpretations of him are just corny and wholesome. You know, the whole, like, for Batman, Batman's the real personality and Bruce Wayne's the disguise. And for Superman, Clark Kent is the real personality and Superman is the disguise.
Oh yeah, in Matt Fraction's Jimmy Olsen series, there are lots of sequences where Jimmy Olsen is interacting with Clark Kent and Superman, but when Jimmy and Superman are alone, he's talking as Clark to him. And I thought that was just a very well done sequence.
And, you know, in those interpretations of him as the wholesome nerd, his villains are extra frustrated by him because he has all that power and in their minds he's using it wrong.
And in those Richard Donner movies, half of it is set up as it takes place in the cynical New Hollywood, New York type situation. But then here comes this Norman Rockwell Superman. And in the first act, yeah, he has to convince Margot Kidder that he's for real.
Yeah.
Like, that this isn't an act. This is exactly who he is. And it's nice to think that, you know, for once, somebody who has this amount of power over us isn't Donald Trump or Elon Musk or Bill Clinton or anybody else who would abuse their authority in some capacity. It's just a guy who, he's just nice, and he usually has great judgment. That's a fantasy, too.
That's my personal fantasy.
So. Especially a powerful white dude that you don't have to be afraid of?
Yeah. I mean, especially when he's contrasted with Batman, like, when Batman is like, I don't trust any of my friends, so I'm going to come up with different ways to kill them all as a backup plan, and then that goes wrong.
Every fucking time.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Superman doesn't worry about killing his friends.
I mean, he does, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
I think the main reason why reactionaries are so upset over not only diversity both amongst the people who create comics and also the people who are depicted in comics is because the power is starting to be shared. Suddenly, it's not just white dudes who get to be Superman. There's also Icon and Blue Marvel and various other figures. And you know, they're freaking out about Carol Danvers, who is very much an exemplar of the military-industrial complex. First Captain Marvel is essentially Top Gun, but since she's, like, a girl boss feminist, that alone is enough to set them in conniptions. But yeah, even in that case, they're just like, no, the aspirational power fantasy, that belongs to us and us alone. If you are brown or gay or have lady bits or anything else, then you're not allowed to feel that way about yourself.
Or God forbid, more than one at the same time. It blows their mind that, like, you might have more than one marginalized identity at the same time. They think you're automatically fictional.
You don't actually exist, so then I don't know. You're actually just a figment of my imagination.
Yeah, I made a joke the other night at my son's band concert when we were leaving because our sister exclaimed, like, shock that there's a D&D club there. And I was like, yeah, everything that we were made fun of for in high school is cool now. And three other parents all cackled and were like, preach.
That's fantastic. But yeah, no, I mean, back to the topic at hand, I do think that it is kind of interesting to kind of see through that lens, too, because, you know, when I think about, like, Captain Marvel, for example, and how it's basically Top Gun with a brainwashed superhero, I think people forget the context of, like, when these stories were written, too, because, like I said, we were looking at very early Superman, proto-Superman, basically, and just realizing how much of, like, the Great Depression and World War II kind of shaped the character even to this day. And I think a lot of the reactionaries, I can see where this is going in terms of, like, the backlash, in terms of all the DEI initiatives when it comes to superheroes. I think people forget, like, you were saying, like, the X-Men is literally to help downtrodden marginalized groups, and I think, you know, Superman, maybe not to a full extent, considering that so many people will probably have that Superman S tattoo on their freaking shoulders, because I see every pseudo bodybuilder kind of guy having that same tattoo, and I always cringe, because, like, that's not the point of the logo, it's not, or the power fantasy of all that power. It's just very weird to me seeing it from that lens as well, too, that so many people kind of, like, are more fixated on the power rather than the personality, and that's always confused me from any sort of reactionary.
Yeah, as Sylvan put it, Superman's villains are like, you have this power and you're using it wrong. Why aren't you ruling the planet? Darkseid doesn't get Superman. The Phantom Zone criminals do not get Superman. Every time Zod gets out of the Phantom Zone, he's just like, he's so disappointed that Superman hasn't conquered Earth yet. But anyways, we're closing in on 2 hours. Is there anything that anyone would like to say about Superman before we close out?
I'm sure we'll do more Superman media in the future, so I'm good. I mean, we didn't even talk about Crypto because he didn't exist yet.
Yeah. We got a lot to say about Crypto and Streaky and even Beppo the Super Monkey. And Supergirl's...
Comet the Super Horse.
Oh, Supergirl's relationship with Comet the Super Horse.
So I only know about Crypto and Super Horse. I don't know who the other two are.
So there will be a part two.
Yeah, there will definitely be a part two. No, I just want to say thanks for inviting me, and that hopefully I get invited back to do more Superman material for sure. Because I would love to talk about Power Girl too, because she's also a favorite of mine.
Okay, well, thanks for listening, everybody. If you got to the end, congratulations. Gold star.
It's like when you put the four Valentines together and talk about X-Men or Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.